We'll call the meeting of the House Agriculture Rural Development Committee meeting to order, March 22nd, 2006, 2:30 p.m. We do not have a quorum yet, but we will start on the first bill where we have an author. So we will then officially call the meeting to order as soon as we have a quorum and take care of some housekeeping issues and then be voting on bills. My first question is Representative Pawlowski in attendance here at this point? Okay, then we'll go to item next. We will go to the Legislative Auditor's Report. Representative Hansen is not here. Okay, we will go to the Legislative Auditor's Report, then we'll go back up to the top and start working our way down again. There's no votes. It's not a bill. I did want the Legislative Auditor on the agenda to present the pesticide regulation and monitoring programs through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Is there anyone here representing the department at this point? Okay.
He may not leave. There is
we will.
Here. He may not have heard you. The
okay.
Deputy Commissioner's here.
Okay. Okay, let's start. We're very fortunate today here to have, is Joe Voss here?
No.
Okay, we'll have Jody Hauer and...
And I will have some opening remarks.
Okay. Okay, Perry Osnes is here. Opening remarks.
Oh.
Okay, if you could please identify yourself for the record, please, sir, and present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Jody Power, the co-manager of our evaluation of pesticide regulation. She's going to take about 15 minutes to briefly summarize our findings and recommendations. I might mention that Joe Voss is unable to be with us. She was also a manager of this project, but she had a death in her family. Mr. Chairman, I do want to preface Ms. Howard's remarks by emphasizing just a couple of points. We certainly understand that pesticides are controversial, and there are strong opinions about when, where, and how they should be used and regulated. Most farmers and other people involved in agriculture see pesticides as an essential element to their economic success, much like good weather. And many homeowners and business operators in both rural and urban areas view pesticides as helpful, even necessary, as they deal with unwanted pests inside and outside of their homes and businesses. On the other side, there are people who believe that pesticides are causing great harm, both to people and the environment. They firmly believe that there is strong evidence that pesticides do harm the environment and human health. And they advocate for, at the very least, higher standards, stronger regulation, and much more encouragement of pesticide-free gardening, lawn care, farming, and other business operations that currently use pesticides. The Office of the Legislative Auditor is participating in this sometimes heated debate, but only in a very limited way, and certainly not as an advocate for one side or the other. Our role was to evaluate and now report to you on how well the Department of Agriculture is managing its regulatory responsibilities. The first thing to be said about that is that the department, like departments in other states, relies heavily on federal testing, registration, and labeling to help ensure that pesticide use does not result in unreasonably harmful effects. Despite this heavy reliance on the federal regulatory process, the department does have serious regulatory responsibilities to fulfill. For example, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture licenses pesticides applicators and dealers, regulates pesticide storage, monitors pesticide use, investigates complaints, and attempts to ensure the safe disposal of unused pesticides. In addition, the department has important responsibilities to monitor the effects of pesticides on groundwater and surface water. Other state agencies also are involved in ground and surface water monitoring, the Department of Health, Pollution Control, Department of Natural Resources. But I want to emphasize that we did not evaluate the activities of these departments. The focus of our evaluation was on the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And in all of the department's areas of responsibility, it has harsh critics. Some think the department is too heavy-handed. but others think the department is not aggressive enough. In fact, some environmental organizations think it is a fundamental conflict of interest to have the Minnesota Department of Agriculture even involved in pesticide regulation. Again, we are not here to take sides in that policy debate. We are here to tell you that based on our evaluation, we think the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is doing a good job. That does not mean we think that pesticides do no harm or that the department should receive a perfect score. Our report contains numerous critical findings and 11 recommendations for improvement, all in the direction of doing more to protect people and the environment. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I do want to thank the department for their cooperation. Throughout our evaluation, they were professional and responsive and cooperative in every way, and I thank them for that. And I again thank you for this opportunity to present our report. And now I'd like to turn to Ms. Hauer for that presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. We'll go now to Jody Hauer. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Jody Hauer. As you just heard in Jim Noble's remarks, the federal government has control over regulating the use of pesticides, but states can impose stricter controls, and Minnesota has done that. Now, in today's presentation, I'm going to cover the main findings of our evaluation of how well the Minnesota Department of Agriculture regulates pesticides.
Ms. Howard, before we do that, I will officially call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee to order. Representative Coonan has thoroughly read the minutes and moves their approval. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, members, we're going to finish up with what Ms. Howard has. Then it will be my intention to go to the Pawlowski bill, Hansen bill, and write down the line. If there's authors that aren't here, we'll just go to the next one and go back up. So, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The law does grant certain powers to the Department of Agriculture as a way to protect public health and the environment from harmful exposure to pesticides. And overall, we concluded that the department is generally doing a good job of regulating and monitoring pesticide use, but we believe that it needs to make some improvements in what we consider to be key areas. The areas where improvements are needed are going to be the basis of my presentation today, and I'll cover them in this order. First, we'll look at enforcement actions that the department has imposed. Second will be investigations of alleged misuse of pesticides. Third is access to information about pesticide applications. Fourth, disposal of waste pesticides. Fifth, the department's efforts in monitoring the use and environmental effects of pesticides. And finally, best management practices, which are voluntary guidelines on how pesticides are best used. So we'll start with enforcement actions. The Department of Agriculture has imposed a substantial number of enforcement actions over the years when it detects violations of pesticide law. In 2004, the department imposed 430 enforcement actions. The yellow bars on this chart behind me represent the rate of enforcement actions imposed per investigation that the department undertook. And as you see, over time, there's been a gradual increase in this rate. Now, we compared Minnesota with 10 other similar states, and we saw that in Minnesota, 51% of the inspections resulted in some kind of enforcement action. This rate was the third highest of the 11 states. Now, some may wonder whether the enforcement actions that the department imposes are just a mere slap on the wrist or whether they're more substantial. Well, the department uses a wide range of enforcement actions. The mildest is a written letter called an advisory notice. And among the strongest are those that involve a monetary penalty. We saw that in 2004, about 3% of the enforcement actions were on that mild end with the advisory notice. And on the other end of the spectrum, 21% of the enforcement actions involved monetary penalties. We looked over time at the rate of enforcement actions that carried monetary penalties, and the red line on this graph shows that since 2000, this rate of enforcement actions with monetary penalties has increased. Now, the problem that we found is that the department is unable to determine whether the full range of its enforcement actions, from those very mildest actions all the way up to the monetary penalties, is consistent and effective. The department does take certain steps to analyze whether violators would have similar backgrounds, similar histories of violations, received similar punishments. But the department lacks an adequate database to analyze whether violators who have similar histories have consistently received the same kinds of punishments throughout the entire spectrum of enforcement actions. So we recommend that the department evaluate how consistent and effective its enforcement actions are, and the department expects that a new database it's currently installing will allow it to undertake that kind of an evaluation. I'm going to move on now to investigations of alleged misuse of pesticides. Among the most serious of the cases that the Department of Agriculture investigates are those alleging misuse of pesticides that expose humans or animals to pesticides. We found overall that the department generally has a reasonable process for investigating these types of complaints. We reviewed all 94 such cases since the year 2000. For the most part, we found that the department starts the investigations promptly. This, of course, is important in investigations where the pesticides or other evidence might deteriorate. Most of the cases they start are closed within 6 months, which meets the timing guideline the department has set for these types of cases. We found that the department substantiated violations in 50% of these cases that we reviewed. In the other half, the department either could not substantiate that the applicator broke the law or determined that the applicator had not applied pesticides on the day in question, or the department couldn't identify who the applicator was or, in some cases, even whether an application had occurred. We found that the department's most frequent enforcement actions for these cases involving human or animal exposure were the most serious of the department's enforcement actions. And you can see by the red slice in the pie on this chart behind me that 41% of these cases where violations were found did result in enforcement actions with monetary penalties. We had a concern, though, about one of the methods that the inspectors used to review the pesticide application records. Applicators, of course, are required to keep records of their pesticide applications, and when inspectors begin investigating a case, part of their job is to inspect and get a copy of those application records. Now, the inspectors in Minnesota are responsible for fairly large geographic sections of the state. One inspector might account for a 10-county area, for instance. Because of that, they will sometimes interview the pesticide applicator by telephone and ask the applicator to send in, either by fax or by mail, a copy of the pesticide application record. In most cases, this is not a problem. It works well in a lot of cases. However, some cases are, by their nature, very adversarial. And in those cases where the actual pesticide application is in doubt or the date of the application is disputed, we question whether the department can be assured that it has all relevant information unless it goes on site and personally inspects the records in person. As a result, we recommend that the department change its procedures by specifying those circumstances under which the inspectors should go on-site and review the records in person. Moving on to information about pesticide applications. We concluded that this information is not sufficiently available for all people who could be affected by pesticide applications. Now, in Minnesota, most of you will know that the pesticide application records are classified as either private or non-public data. This means that people who live or work next to a site that's being treated do not have legal access to the information on those records. And there are really only a few situations when our statutes require pesticide applicators to either provide notice before they apply the pesticide or post signs warning that an application has been made. We learned that 5 states similar to Minnesota do have additional requirements that turf applicators must follow. These requirements apply to any application to grass, lawns, right-of-ways, golf courses, public parks, and the like. In these other states, the applicators have to provide either advance notice or they have to post warning signs before they apply pesticides. Beyond that, 3 states, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Ohio, require that beekeepers who are within a certain distance of the application receive advance notice before an applicator can apply any pesticide that is toxic to bees. Now, in Minnesota, some beekeepers have lost a significant number of bees when the bees foraged among plants where pesticides had recently been applied. Last year, in summer of 2005, the state Supreme Court had a decision that found landowners with knowledge of bees that are foraging have a duty to avoid injuring the bees by when applying pesticides toxic to those bees. Now, we believe that the legislature should require land managers to provide advance notice of their pesticide applications when they're using pesticides toxic to bees. And this is only when the nearby beekeeper would request such notice in advance. We think this can be done without creating a new bureaucracy to process the information. And we think that beyond that, the department should evaluate how well this works once it's been implemented, and then report back to the legislature on the feasibility of extending similar requirements to other applications that might demonstrate a threat to human health or pose serious economic harm. The next point is related to collecting waste pesticides. We concluded that the department is not currently meeting its statutory obligations in this area. Statutes do require that the department have a program in place to collect waste pesticides and that it provide a place at least every other year for residents in each county to dispose of their waste pesticides. For the years between 1989 and 2003, the department held one-day collection events in certain parts of the state, and this allowed farmers and agricultural businesses to drop off their waste pesticides at these collection events. But this changed in fiscal year 2004. In place of the one-day events, which the department had concluded were not very efficient, the department changed its program by requesting that household hazardous waste facilities, which, as you may know, are run by groups of counties around the state, collect these wastes and then dispose of them, with the state picking up the bill for transportation and disposal costs. The only problem with this plan is that not every county agreed to participate. As a result, at the end of 2005, we still had 29 counties, so a third of our counties, who had not agreed to participate, and most of these are counties that are highly agricultural in nature. Consequently, the department's program does fall short of statutory requirements. We recommend that the department make some changes to its program, and we think that having disposal options available statewide will likely be far less costly than the prospect of having to clean up contamination from pesticides that might otherwise be inappropriately dumped for lack of an appropriate disposal option. Now I'm going to move on to our findings related to how well the department meets its statutory obligation in monitoring the use of pesticides. We think that the department is doing a good job measuring rural or agricultural use of pesticides, as statutes require it to do. But that's not the case for urban use of pesticides. Regarding rural use, the department has begun to issue annual reports every other year regarding the amount of pesticides that farmers use and the different management techniques that they use. By contrast, though, we found that the department does not have anything similar to measure urban pesticide use. Although it has done some things in this area, it has provided some educational mechanisms for certain subgroups of the urban population. We do recommend that the department develop and implement a consistent approach to monitoring urban pesticide use, and we have in our report a couple of suggestions for how they might do that. We also looked at how well the department monitors the effects of pesticides on groundwater and surface water. Before I get into discussing the findings there, it's important to keep three points in mind. The first is that state and federal laws say that the normal use of pesticides should not result in unreasonable adverse effects on the environment, taking into account economic, social, and environmental costs and benefits of using the pesticides. Second, Minnesota's 1989 Groundwater Protection Act says that groundwater ought to be maintained in its natural condition, free from human degradation. The Act recognizes, though, that for some human activities, this may not be practical. Finally, there are standards that identify the maximum level of pesticides for groundwater and other standards for surface water. These standards, though, are not set by the Department of Agriculture. Instead, it's the Department of Health that develops these standards for groundwater, and it's the Pollution Control Agency that develops standards for surface waters. Now, overall, we think that the department does a fairly good job monitoring groundwater for pesticides. The map on this slide shows the department's groundwater monitoring sites. The number and location of the sites have increased substantially since this network was first implemented in year 2000. Now, in addition to the sites you see marked on the map, the department plans to add additional sites in the northwestern, north central, and east central sections of the state both this year and in 2007. Now, most of these monitoring sites, as you can tell, are in agricultural areas, but the department also does monitor groundwater in the Twin Cities, in Rochester, and in St. Cloud. Plus, the department has developed and implemented a fairly rigorous quality control program for collecting and monitoring its water samples from these collection sites. Now, by contrast, we found that the department's surface water program is less comprehensive because it doesn't have an urban component as the groundwater program does. Now, this slide shows where the department monitors surface water. And as with groundwater, the department has significantly expanded the number and location of the sites where it gathers surface water samples since 2000. However, the monitoring sites are located primarily in rural areas. Some of the sites do have are located in areas that have both agricultural and some residential use, but the department does not monitor any surface waters in strictly urban or strictly residential areas. And, of course, because it doesn't collect any samples from urban areas, the department does not analyze any of these water samples for the kinds of pesticides that are used in urban areas. Well, we recommend that the department expand its surface water monitoring program starting into the sensitive urban areas, and then at a minimum analyze these samples for the non-agricultural pesticides. Well, what do these monitoring results show from the department's monitoring programs? Overall, we found that pesticides are showing up in groundwater and in surface water at concentration levels that are at times high relative to the standards. Now, over the last 4.5 years, the department has frequently detected 5 pesticides or their degradates in groundwater. Now, degradates are the substances that result when pesticides decompose. The concentration levels, though, of these pesticides have rarely exceeded the appropriate groundwater standard set by the Department of Health. For these last 4.5 years, the department analyzed 760 samples of groundwater, and only 2 samples exceeded the groundwater standards. Some of the same pesticides frequently detected in groundwater are also frequently detected in surface water, especially in the samples that are collected right after a rain event because of all the storm runoff that occurs. 2 pesticides, atrazine and acetachlor, have been detected in some sites at concentrations that exceeded the surface water standard for those pesticides. However, I should point out that doesn't mean that these bodies of water where those concentrations occurred are classified as impaired water. That's a determination that the Pollution Control Agency, not the Department of Agriculture, makes. And when the PCA makes those classifications, it looks at the concentration levels over a series of days as opposed to a one-time event. The Department of Ag, though, uses the results of its monitoring to develop best management practices, which are the voluntary guidelines intended to prevent further degradation of water. We found that the department has not developed a specific strategy for evaluating whether the best management practices have been followed or how well they're working. The department did issue best management practices in February of 2004. They have groundwater best management practices for 5 pesticides. They have surface water best management practices for 2 pesticides. And they also have a generic set of best management practices for general use of herbicides. So we believe that the department has been assertive in developing the best management practices for specific agricultural pesticides. But we think the department needs to immediately begin to evaluate the extent to which these practices have been implemented by farmers and the effect that they're having on the pesticides in groundwater and in surface water, which is something statutes require the department to do. Mr. Chair, I'm going to finish by just recapping our major recommendations. We recommend that the department evaluate the consistency of the enforcement actions that it imposes for violations of pesticide laws. We recommend that it change its procedures regarding how it collects information while investigating certain types of pesticide applications. We recommend that the legislature require advance notice for a specific type of pesticide application. We recommend that the department ensure that waste pesticide disposal options exist around the states, that the department monitor urban pesticide use, that it expand its surface water monitoring into urban areas, and finally, that it evaluates the best management practices that it has promulgated. So with that, Mr. Chair, I conclude my remarks. I'd be glad to answer any questions that anyone may have about our report.
Okay, thank you very much. How many folks have questions? I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to keep you folks here. We've got a gentleman that's driven quite a ways on the next bill. So if you could stick around for a little bit, we'll go back to the beginning of the agenda. So if you've got questions, we're not cutting off questions. We won't do that. We will have questions for the legislative auditor. Let's see. And we're going to go back up. We're going to call, and the department will have a chance to respond, too. My intention now is to go. I'm going to go to the Hansen bill right now, and I'm going to move House File 3418, and then we'll go to the Plowski bill. So if you come on up with the Plowski bill, that's fine. Representative Hansen's not here. We just want to get it out of here. House File 3418, I'll move the Hansen bill. We had a full hearing on it yesterday. Is there anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against it, or any member questions? Seeing none, I'll move that House File 3418 be recommended to pass and sent to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee. We need to get these out of here so we can get moving. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That was the bill we had the full hearing on yesterday. Thank you, members, for that. I like doing that sometimes when the author comes in and all done.
All done.
This is kind of fun. Okay, Representative Pawlowski, welcome to the Ag Committee. I will move House File 3066. I'll be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. I do not believe there is any amendments. Representative Pawlowski, if you could please describe your bill. And members, we want to work on this one. The gentleman here does have some other commitments he needs to get to. So,
Mr. Chairman?
This one went to the Environment Policy.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Rudolph.
Just a technical problem here. Before we get too far along, that thing flickers off and on every time. Do we put in a formal request somewhere to get it fixed?
The committee legislative assistant will check on that because it drives me crazy.
Because
then we wonder if... Yeah, thank you. The point well taken, and we will check that out. Representative Pawlowski, to your bill, sir.
Mr. Chair, thank you. House File 3066 comes at the request of Mr. Robert Marr, who is sitting next to me. Although he is a constituent, actually, of Representative Swiggums, he's a longtime friend of the family, and he had contacted myself, Representative Welty, Representative David, Senator Murphy, and Representative Swiggum over an incident that occurred on his farm, which was unfortunate, dealing with the purchase of a shrub that he did not know at the time was toxic. And I think the best thing I can do now, I'll just briefly say that the bill would require the Commissioner of Ag to establish procedures dealing with these types of materials, to work with the organizations such as the nursery stock growers, dealers, and retailers, and then to report back to the legislature on what procedures would be put in place to prevent what you're about to hear. So with that, Mr. Marg has come over 2 hours, and he's a farmer, so he's got to get back and do his work. But he'll tell you what occurred, and this is an extremely unfortunate incident.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. First of all, before we start the testimony, what's the team name of the Altura school?
The team name?
Yeah.
Cardinals.
Cardinals. I was somewhat distressed that we had we were talking about Lewiston yesterday, and they said the Lewiston Cardinals, and I said, no, it's not the Lewiston Cardinals, it's the Lewiston
Altura.
And as far as Wasika went, it was interesting. He said, well, something blue, and it's like a bird. But he didn't. I don't know if you caught that, remember, it was the Blue Jays, but whatever. Okay, he was very, very close. Okay, with that being said, is there anyone that wishes to testify in opposition to the bill? We have one person. Anyone else that wishes to testify for the bill? Okay, we'll hold on just a second. We'll let the gentleman present his story, and then we'll go to someone that has concerns. Welcome to the committee. Sir, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record and present your testimony.
I'm Robert Meyer. I'm from Altura, Minnesota. We had bought some shrubbery for around the house, which was Japanese yew. There was nothing on the label or anything that said it was poisonous. We had no clue that it was poisonous. And we had cut it off because it was getting too big and took it out to our burn pile, at which our cattle are pastured around that area. And I had two milk cows that actually ate just a little piece of it, and it killed them both. It only takes, I found out, an 8-inch branch will kill a full-grown cow. And the stuff is poisonous to about anything that will eat it, including people. And I raised six kids on the farm there with the stuff growing there, and kids chew on anything. And so I started asking, when I went up to the state fair the next year, I asked the horticulture people at the state fair about it and if there's some way to label it. And the only answer I could get is that it's not the law, we don't have to. And then after that, they would proceed by saying that if we labeled it as highly poisonous, nobody would buy it. Which, you know, I somewhat agree with. But then in checking, they said, well, it's not that prevalent. Well, I checked the four farms in the neighborhood. I live on a dead-end road. There's four of us on the end there. All four of us had Japanese yew growing. Nobody knew it was poisonous. I also have a neighbor that lost a cow, Jeff Peshin, and they couldn't figure out what it died from, but after they figured out that the Japanese yew was poisonous, it was growing close enough to the fence that the cow actually could have reached through the fence and bit some of it off. And so within 2 days, none of the neighbors had Japanese yew in their yards anymore. But I tried basically to go through the horticulture people through the state fair because I didn't know where else to find them, and I always get the same answer. So I called the ag department and asked them if there's some kind of law that could require these people to report on at least the most poisonous of these plants, or, you know, make the public more aware of the more poisonous plants that they're selling. And they checked and got back to me in about a month and said there's nothing on the books right now. So that's why I actually had called you first, or I called Steve Swagum first. He says he didn't have time to write it, and he asked me to call you, and your office had it wrote up for me, and I called Gene, I called Andy Welty, and to ask different questions about it, and that I'm not requesting that these plants are totally banned or anything like that. I just would like that the public be made more aware of the poisonous plants, because my loss was two cows, which were valued at over $3,000. And I also talked to Neil Broadwater, who used to be our county extension agent, who's now the regional extension agent out of Rochester. And he basically agreed with me that, yes, this should be something that's made more aware of, if not totally banned on some of the plants.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So basically, Representative Pawlowski, we're looking at providing a simple point-of-sale consumer education piece saying that watch out for this stuff.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, if the...
Yeah. Oh,
excuse me?
The bill?
We're on 3066.
Okay.
Yeah?
I've got a question. To the bill?
Oh, to the bill, yes. Yes, to the bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Pawlowski. On the first or initial endorsement that I received, on Section 1, it stated consumer education. It said toxicity of some nursery stock to animals and humans, and now it's dropped off a portion of that. And I'm wondering why and if we could put that back in there.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is the final version of the bill. And again, Representative Davids had drafted the initial version, and then I put it in. So I'm not adverse to having that put back in, but I'm going to... The person who is testifying against the bill may have some objection to it, but okay. Initially that was a concern that we did have, that this particular plant, no matter who consumes it, it is going to probably die from the consumption of it, mm-hmm. whether it's animal or human.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's hear from, we'll come back, Chris, from Hamilton on your thoughts on that. Let's hear from the gentleman that has some concerns. It's Mr. Tim Power, Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and let us know what your concerns are about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, and Mr. Meyer, and committee members. My name is Tim Power. I'm a nursery stock grower in Hastings and also the president of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, a trade association that represents 1,500 member firms, and those firms do about $2.1 billion worth of business in the state of Minnesota. First, let me say that I'm extremely sorry that this happened, because it could be a very costly thing. And let me predict the results of a study that MDA might produce. They will come up with two sets of recommendations. One is passive and the second is active. If they recommend a passive approach, that would be to update and to publicize the documentation that exists already or may exist in the next year or two regarding poisonous plants. I did a Google search yesterday on poisonous plants and came up with a list of quite a few documents that reference the poison nature of yews, among other things, to livestock and to humans. And by the way, just a side note, yews are not as prevalent in the state of Pennsylvania as they might be, because deer are eating so much in the way of yew and are not killed by it, that they are actually knocking back the native populations of yew. So these things are poisonous to selective things. Admittedly, yew is quite poisonous to humans, and it's quite poisonous to much livestock. Therefore, if a passive approach is taken by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in its approach to this problem, I predict that there will be a momentary rise in public awareness of poisonous plants, and then we will go back to status quo. The second alternative is what I would call an active approach, and that is the requirement levied by MDA that nursery stock retailers include some signage language with respect to nursery stock that is potentially poisonous. I have severe concerns about that. Not only is it difficult to add more verbiage to a label that's already extremely verbose, but I'm concerned about one state's taking action against a problem, whereas surrounding states are not. The competitive disadvantage of my nursery stock labeled as poisonous compared to Wisconsin nursery stock not labeled as poisonous brings to mind some problems down the road. I think I would have an extremely difficult time telling my retail members of my association that this is coming down the road. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have. That is my testimony at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Power. Doesn't it make some sense, however, that if something's poisonous, people should maybe like know about it?
Absolutely. And my question is, whose responsibility should that be? I believe that the retail garden centers and nurseries have an opportunity to use the poison plant issue along with the edible plant issue as a consumer education piece. I think it should be an opportunity rather than a requirement. I find it hard to believe that the big box stores who sell nursery stock are going to undertake consumer education pieces and provide the kind of literature that I think would be most effective in the same way that the small garden centers that I represent will do.
Okay, thank you. Representative Blaine Hamilton, the mower. Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the witnesses or even to the author. I'm not sure, as I did, we'll come in a little bit late here, but if you had brought any pictures or samples of this plant, the Japanese yew, you know, I guess I'm not familiar with this, or if there is a spot on the internet or a website we could go to that would show us what this plant looks like. I mean, I certainly, as a dairy producer too, would like to know if I've got any of this growing around out there, this or any other toxic plant out there that we may want to address, you know, outside of like broccoli and Brussels sprouts.
They can be toxic too at times.
To me, they are.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Blaine, Mr. Power. I did a Google search using the words poisonous plants, and the top selection that showed up was one, I believe, from Colorado State that included a list of poisonous plants. I scrolled down to view, hit on that, and saw pictures and descriptions of which livestock it is poisonous to and what parts of it are poisonous for humans. And I think that there are myriad sources available on the Internet. I did do some checking with the University of Minnesota woody plant researcher and the University of Minnesota's nursery extension specialist. And both of them concur that while some of the publications could use an update, certainly they yew has been listed as a poisonous plant for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. There are biblical references to poisonous plants, and of course many in literature. But certainly to find yew, it would be extremely simple to get there. I would concede that it is a passive approach. You have to understand that you're looking for a poisonous plant. If you are unaware that it's poisonous, that may not be your concern. I will concede that.
Is this Japanese yew, is this prevalent? Is its existence prevalent across the state, or is this more prevalent or confined more to, let's say, Representative Plowski's southeastern part of the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Power?
This plant is quite prevalent statewide and nationwide in the northern half of the country. It's used in Minnesota, in particular, on the north side of buildings where many things that are shade intolerant will not grow. It actually requires the shade and thrives in under those conditions.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, when my wife and I go out shopping for food products or other things to use around the house, those products that we purchase for a variety of reasons, it seems to me that virtually anything else that I were to go out to purchase would have a warning label on that if it were to be toxic in any way to myself, my wife, my dogs, or our kids that were to come over to our house. So my question to you would be, why should your industry be an exception to this rule? And it would seem to me that your association would have a vested interest in public health and safety. And why would you? The second question: why would you not want to,
Mr. Power?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, I believe that we do have a vested interest in consumer education. I do believe that my industry has a vested interest in letting people know about the poisonous plants issue. And my response back would be, where do you draw the line? There are literally hundreds of plants that are poisonous to one degree or another to humans, pets, or livestock. And to include the poisonous label on all nursery stock that has any poisonous characteristics of any kind, I think would be extremely onerous to the industry, would be difficult to maintain sales when we believe that with a few exceptions, and yews are one of them, that the danger is minimal.
Representative Moe?
Yeah, just to follow up then. Well, I know of other plants. For example, on the north side of our property, we plant ferns and conifers, which are pretty shade tolerant. It would seem to me there'd be an opportunity for yew and your association to sell more of these plants and market them in a way in which, hey, these are both appropriate for the location and shade tolerant. I mean, it would seem more, you could look at it more as an opportunity to sell appropriate products as opposed to ones that can kill our dairy cows or, you know, other, perhaps kids.
Mr. Power?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, unfortunately, I don't think that those plants are quite as interchangeable as you suggest. And my industry believes, and I agree, that yews have a place in the landscape. They may not, or they certainly are not near spots where livestock can approach them. And certainly there needs to be more education of the public of those facts. Again, my question is, in response, whose responsibility is that? Again, I view it as a nursery industry's opportunity, but I don't see the entirety of my industry, including the big box stores, not to pick on them in particular, but there is only a segment of my industry that will take that opportunity and use it.
Just to follow up then, well, it seems we're in the business in the legislature of finding where that line is. You know, we deal in this, and it seems in my estimation where this plant with a certain, a very small amount would kill a couple dairy cows, I mean, it seems that that falls within that line that we would want to establish. So I understand your point, but a label in order to save the dairy cows of your consumers would seem both in your best interest and theirs.
And I thank you, Representative Ball. Mr. Parr, I have some problem with saying that it put us at a competitive disadvantage in the state. I mean, I did some extensive research and found out that when they put a warning label that said don't drink Drano, Drano sales didn't go down. It's just, but it's good to know that you shouldn't be drinking Drano. I mean, it'll clean you out. But Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just some comments and then a question. Number one, listening to your comments, I appreciate them. I'm trying to think, but almost every nursery, big box person, or anywhere else I go now does have labels or markers, white state markers in with the plants I buy, which tells me what kind of light they need, tells me how much water to put on them. I'm not so sure that we couldn't develop a toxicity rating from minor to hazardous, or, you know, that we couldn't put on there too. I don't know that that's a big problem. I don't see where it would be a like Representative David said, a competitive disadvantage to Wisconsin. What we're talking about is point of sale labeling. You can still sell your stuff to Wisconsin. If they don't require labeling at point of sale, it's not up to you. It's up to the nurseries, and vice versa, the people selling in from Wisconsin to our state, if we require point of sale, I don't understand that there wouldn't be any disadvantage to a stock producer like yourself or your other members. So I guess I'm sure the department would come up with some fairly good recommendations like that. I would think that your industry would be more concerned about a farmer like this. I'm surprised he's sitting here and he's not down in small claims court trying to get the reimbursement for two cattle from the nursery where he bought his Japanese ewe. To me, that would be a longer-term problem, or that cat that ate the houseplant, or the, I mean, we can go on and on, veterinary bills and things that may be reimbursable. I'm surprised that your industry isn't seeing more of that, particularly if there's poisonous things. My question to you, specifically, or the department, if they know, we're one of 50 states. What do other states do? As far as identifying toxicity of plants, I can't believe that this is groundbreaking legislation here. Maybe it is, but
Representative Duncan, Minnesota is a leader.
I know we are. It's on some things.
Mr. Power.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duncan, I cannot answer your question because I do not know.
And Mr. Chair, precisely the point why I think this is asking for a report back to legislature. That's precisely why I think this is good legislation this time. Let the department tell us what other states are doing, what we can do, some guidelines we can provide, and I think we're going to find maybe next year when the report comes back, April 1st, 2007, that maybe it isn't as onerous as we all thought. The information's readily available. It's not like you have to go out and research the toxicity of these plants. I think it's pretty much available worldwide, and I think it's a pretty good idea, this bill.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my point goes to Representative Junkie's point. We're looking at a report, and from what I have seen, when we bring both sides to the table, we come out with some really good recommendations, and we come back with legislation that both those on the pro side and those on the con side can live with. And I challenge you to think outside the box. Maybe it's going to cost you too much to put that little label in with the plant. What if you came up with a flyer or a pamphlet that upon the sale, all people would be given so they knew what plants were toxic for what animals or for humans? So I think that this provides the industry with a way of sitting down at the table with the consumer and making sure that we protect our consumers. And we come up with some good suggestions that won't harm the industry. So I would encourage all members to vote for this and bring the sides to the table, and let's figure out what would be good for consumer protection.
Thank you, Representative Welch. Any other questions? Representative Pennis.
It's alive. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make one comment that it has to be done all over. Just, it's not only the nursery people here that are, you know, and we have to look at the states around us, as has been said already. But those of us who live close to neighboring states know that if you can go over there and buy a plant and bring it back, sometimes it gives us a false sense of that we're okay. Security. That's the word I was looking for. So, I feel another mandate coming.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3066 be recommended passed and sent to the... Excuse me, Representative Pelosi, you have any other comments? Thank you. I would move that House File 3066 be recommended passed and sent to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Pelosi and Mr. Marge and Mr. Power. Item next, we will finish up with the Legislative Auditor's Report. If Jody Hauer and Mr. Nobles can come back to the table. And also, did anyone from the Department of Ag have any thoughts, or do you just want to be available for questions? Or Perry Austin, if you could come down and make a few comments, or available for questions? Or okay, come on down. You're next. Let's hear from the department and have all three sitting down here. And then we'll open up for members' questions. I know there's several members that have questions. I believe Representative Pennis was on the list for a question. Who else had a question? Representative Otremba? And then we'll go from there. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please, sir, and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Perry Osnes, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Agriculture. Just wanted to make a few brief comments regarding the auditor's report. I also have staff here to answer any particular questions you may have. First off, just want to commend Mr. Nobles and his staff for their work in conducting an evaluation of the department's pesticide program. I don't need to tell this committee, but obviously pesticides are valuable tools that help control pests and protect crop, landscape, plants, and public health. We also recognize that when used improperly, pesticides can create problems for human, animal, and plant health. It's our job as a department to ensure that laws and rules related to pesticide use are enforced. We take this responsibility seriously, and while the report determined several changes were needed to further strengthen pesticide management in Minnesota, we're gratified that the audit found that overall the MDA does a good job in regulating and monitoring pesticides, and that we compare favorably with a number of other states that are similar to Minnesota. Having said that, we also recognize that there's room for improvement. The report makes several recommendations that will provide guidance in those areas where we can focus our efforts to improve our efforts and do a better job in regulating pesticides. The report makes 11 recommendations, 10 of which are directed to the Department of Ag. We've reviewed these recommendations and believe as a whole they have merit. Just three general themes I'd like to briefly mention that I wanted to comment on. The first one relates to urban pesticide use. That was one of the recommendations that the department do more in that area. We do agree that more that can be done in the area of monitoring urban pesticide use and monitoring surface water for urban pesticides. While in the past we have conducted some significant work in urban areas, as the report acknowledges, we intend to increase our efforts there while maintaining our work in the rural and ag areas of the state. Under the regulatory and enforcement issues, there are recommendations made in those areas as well. We accept those recommendations that address aspects of our regulatory and enforcement programs. We believe that overall we have good programs in those areas, but as the audit points out, some additional efforts and changes in protocols can be made. One thing that was mentioned that we are working on already is to develop and improve the electronic data management system that will allow us to better organize and track our enforcement efforts to evaluate the effectiveness of those enforcement actions. Final area I just want to briefly touch on is the environmental program and water monitoring issues. Report acknowledges that the MDA does a good job of monitoring the waters of the state for agricultural pesticides and monitoring the use of ag pesticides, and that we compare very favorably to similar programs in similar states. report does make recommendations primarily for revising the pesticide management plan to provide more detail in several areas. We intend to revisit the pesticide management plan and address the issues suggested by the audit. We'll also move quickly to develop and implement a plan for determining the effectiveness of the pesticide BMPs as recommended in the audit. Mr. Chair, I'll stop with my comments there. I know there may be questions, and we'll be happy to take them.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Ossis. We'll start out with questions for any of the three that are at the table or some tennis.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for anyone. If you look at the two maps that were presented on the auditors, the maps of Minnesota and where the monitoring groundwater and the monitoring surface water, you will see that there are vast areas of the state that are not monitored at all. They're not monitored due to the vast holdings of state land, our land, and a variety of others. Anyway, is the Department of Natural Resources or other doing some monitoring there, because there are pesticides that are used occasionally, not as much as ag land. But. So I guess I'm asking, do you know? I don't anticipate there's anybody here from DNR. But.
Mr. Ossis? Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I don't know what DNR is doing. I know that the Department of Agriculture, though, has the responsibility for monitoring for pesticides in both groundwater and surface water anywhere in the state. So it is the Department of Agriculture's responsibility for monitoring pesticides.
Okay. And
if the gentleman that came down could identify himself, who represent and respond to
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director for Environmental Programs, Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. The reason that there's large parts of the state that are not monitored, particularly for groundwater, is that much of the soils in the state really doesn't have much of a groundwater risk. Southwest Minnesota, you've got areas that have 1 to 200 feet of clay tills. There really isn't much to monitor in those areas. In all of northeast Minnesota, there really isn't much ag, and so we haven't spent a lot of money out there. And then for the surface water, we have made an effort to make sure that we're covering most of the state for surface water.
Just to follow up. Well, I look on the surface water, and you haven't done much with the northeast up there, and the northwest doesn't look too good either. A couple blotches on the Red River. But anyway, no matter what, it has to be comprehensive. I mean, we have to have comprehensive. Now, I'll agree with you, there's not a lot of ag, but there are pesticides used on some state land for one roach or another.
Mrs. Stoddard?
Mr. Chair, we worked with the University of Minnesota to do some modeling, and we used an agro-ecoregion approach to identify areas that are highest risk and also look at pesticides that are used the most. And based on that, we identified a number of what we call pesticide monitoring areas. And they're supposed to cover the entire state. And what we've tried to do is to focus our resources on those monitoring areas that have the greatest risk. So we have actually put quite a bit of effort into identifying the locations for our monitoring efforts.
Mr. Panis?
Okay.
No. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sort of asked this question one other time, but I'm going to ask it again in a different kind of way. And that's where you talk about information on certain pesticide applications and only customers, physicians, and veterinarians have legal access to that information. So as you went through the audit process, could you suggest to me who else you might recommend to be able to know what was sprayed and where?
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Otremba, what we say is that, as you know, that who now has access to that information is limited. We think that there are some demonstrated areas where harm has occurred as a result, and we point specifically to the areas where several beekeepers lost their livelihood. And others lost significant numbers of their colonies as a result of bees foraging in areas where pesticides had been used. So we focused our recommendation on those areas where we saw a particular type of pesticide that had resulted in demonstrated harm, and then resulting in our recommendation that the legislature consider requiring advanced notification for those pesticide applications where there has been demonstrated harm.
Representative Tremba.
Okay, thank you. And then I have a couple of questions for the department. The groundwater piece in the rural areas, and I know I've brought this up before also, but I look in my district and the county I live in, we have over 300 lakes, and we have one monitoring well within the two counties I represent, and I wondered why that was. And I also looked at the surface water monitoring area, and again, there was only one surface area that was tested between the two counties I represent. And again, I know that I have over 300 lakes in just Todd County alone. So can you help me out with why there's only one and why and if there will be some in the future?
Mr. Stoddard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tremba, pesticide monitoring is very expensive, particularly the lab costs are quite expensive. And so what we have tried to do is to develop an approach which is representative of regions of the state, but we can't cover all areas. So we worked with the University of Minnesota and did some modeling to identify areas that have similar agricultural practices based on soils, climate, and other factors. And within each of those pesticide monitoring areas, we looked at developing a groundwater monitoring, kind of a mini network specifically for them, and then also a surface water monitoring approach where we would identify two or three locations that have already been gauged, so we know the flow characteristics within those surface waters, and then we sample them using grab samples. So it's true that we cannot force to cover large parts of the state, but we have made an effort to identify locations that are representative of all the different agricultural areas in the state.
Mr. Chair, we also have an ag station, so to speak, in the area, and that testing didn't occur in that area. And when you're connected with the University of Minnesota, I would think that you could at least piggyback on some of that. So,
Mr. Stoddard,
Mr. Chair, Representative Tremba, we do work very closely with the university. With the university that actually did this study for us. But in this case, the locations that we look for are not really linked to the university because they're just monitoring. What we look for is we've developed criteria for groundwater where there is no non-agricultural sources nearby, and then we do some GIS kind of work to identify suitable locations for monitoring, and then we look for a well close to those locations. For surface water, what's very important is the flow patterns in a particular watershed. Every single lake and river has a different hydrograph. And so what we did was we looked for locations where there was gauging information. Gauging information is data that shows the water level of the river. And we only want to sample it during periods where there is high water. And so the Pollution Control Agency has had a gauging station out in place, and so has the USGS for many years. So we really did, we piggybacked on the work done by the Pollution Control Agency and USGS to identify most of our surface water locations.
Representative Tremba?
Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to any more questions, I would like to see a show of hands on the Ellison, Junkie, Welty, Coonan bills. If there's anyone that came in from like over 50 miles to testify, Representative Welty?
They're over the front right now, and they will be here, and they grow up.
So even if we don't get to some of the bills necessarily, we will go to the bills and take their testimony. And if we need more time, we'll at least get their testimony on the record. Or some junkie.
There's people here somewhere. I don't know who they are, but they're in the Senate hearing the bill too.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Junkie and then Erdahl. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably to the department. I think the most interesting part to me of this report, and one I'm guess I'm kind of shocked to learn that we don't do, and I guess I'd like to hear more about how you plan to implement, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the fifth point. The department should develop and implement a consistent approach to monitor urban pesticide use biannually as state law requires. And the reason I bring it up is Representative Ellison's here. I want to get his attention, too. We're going to hear that bill, and that's I think it's a good discussion to have, Representative Ellison. But Representative Ellison is out kind of directing us what to do in rural Minnesota, yet, you know, there are, I'm trying to understand why we wouldn't have a report on pesticide use within the Twin Cities, why we're not monitoring how the sales, at a minimum, the sales of 2,4-D and MCPP and dicamba and the things that go off the shelves within the Twin Cities. Yes, can you round up? Can you say Roundup's actually pretty safe? I'm not worried about that one. But we can't say it's used there, but in all likelihood, it is. It would give us a pretty good handle if we at least had a report of the total pounds of product or gallons of product sold within the 7-county metro area, so we can start making some comparisons with Representative Ellison when he comes out to the rural areas. And fertilizer, the same way. You know, we ban phosphate fertilizer, but in lawn food, but again, it'd be nice to know the total tonnage of nitrogen and nitrates that go down on the lawns within the Twin Cities. You can go out here to the suburban areas. They're gorgeous. I mean, there are, like Kubli told us the other day at a speech he gave at the, I don't know if you were there when he got up, Mr. Chair, but he said he got lost in Golden Valley once and he drove for 19 blocks looking for the place he was supposed to go. And one thing I noted on him, he saw a carpet of green that was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen in his life. He didn't see a dandelion in 19 blocks. And great to be proud of our lawns, but how much pesticides went down to prevent those dandelions from growing in Golden Valley, and how much of that gets into our water system and our surface waters and our groundwaters and Lake Pepin and everything else. So I guess to the department, apparently it's already in law that we're supposed to be biennially reporting and monitoring and understanding pesticide use within the metropolitan area, yet the auditor's telling us we're not doing that good of a job of it. So could you talk about how we're going to, because I think proactively for agriculture, I think that's exactly what the department should be doing to help us in some of these discussions, understand where we do need to put more resources as we move into the Clean Water Legacy Bill and other things.
Mr. Stoddard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jenke, the reason that why we really haven't focused a great effort on urban pesticide use is that it's extremely difficult. We have done some surveys, in particular in cooperation with some monitoring work in small watersheds. We did a lot of work in Lake Harriet and a couple of other watersheds. What we found is that most people have no idea what they're using. Whereas when you deal with an ag audience, most people either know or they're comfortable with you talking to their retailer, and you can find out what kinds of products they've been using. So we have done work in this area. We believe that we're in compliance with statute, but we don't have a consistent approach. What we've done has been kind of piecemeal.
But Mr. Chair, wouldn't the witness concur that at least having a record of sales in the 7-county metro area, we could tell what was being bought every year? It'd be pretty close. I mean, yeah, I might go down to, stop at Menards on the way home to Wilmer and buy some Trimec that I might bring back. But for the most part, point-of-sale stuff is being used in the county or the locale it's being purchased.
Mr. Chair, we agree very much. We talked with the auditor about a number of different options. They looked at the things that we had already looked at. And in the report is that option for converting sales data into use data. Currently, the way we collect sales data, because most labels don't have pounds like they would for an ag application, we couldn't do that. So one option that we're very seriously looking at and probably will implement is exactly what you suggest, where we would require some additional information at the time of registration and that convert that to pounds.
And Mr. Chair, I do think it'd be very good, and I think it's gotten extremely probably easy to report that with barcodes today and other things. We can easily tell what kind of stock is going out of literally every store in this state. And then match that up with the formulation and other things, because it all is labeled. You're exactly right. Granted, it takes some computer programming time and other things, but I think we could get a pretty good snapshot of what's going on as far as sales, product type being sold, pounds being used, et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Stoddard? What we probably would do is require the pesticide registrant to provide us records of sales, and they could put that in a form that we could convert it to pounds, or they would actually report it as pounds annually.
Based on geography.
I'm not sure that we would get a good geographic picture, but we know product use. We know there's about 12 or 13 categories of pesticides that we currently divide pesticide sales into. It includes all kinds of things, not just lawn care, but we're looking at disinfectants and sanitizers and animal products. So we would have a very good idea on sales in each of those categories.
And again, Mr. Chair, I just encourage them to do a geographical survey as much as possible, too. Again, every store in the state knows exactly what stock they sold. They know exactly. They order, you know, by the week. They know how to stock their shelves now. It's incredible. I see no problem with getting a geographic report as part of the requirement process on pesticides, too.
Representative Bernal?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, respond a little bit to Representative Junkie and his observations, Representative Senator Kubley. I don't have that problem. We have a standard observation in my family. I've been trying to convince my wife for years. If it's green, it's grass. We don't worry about it.
In your lawn.
In my lawn. To Mr. Stoddard, last year we did fund more money for groundwater testing. I was just wondering, did any other geographic area of the state benefit more? Did you pick up the testing because of that increase in funding in any other area? Did you look at the urban areas as a possibility with that, or what did you do?
Mr. Stoddard?
Chair Representative Erdahl, most of that money this year has gone to finishing the installation of statewide monitoring wells. That was a big chunk of it. We also used it for developing, or actually collecting samples from the USGS for cyanidine degradants, which our lab is not currently able to run, and routing them to the USGS lab. And thirdly, we're going to spend a good amount of it in bringing in an unclassified temporary hydrologist to develop a monitoring system for southeast Minnesota to help get that implemented. So that's our plan for this year and going into next year. Then in the long term, what we hope to do is convert some of that money into our lab so that we'd be able to do additional samples in urban areas.
Okay, with that, any other questions? Okay, I'd like to thank the legislative auditor, and I'd like to thank the Department of Agriculture for their report. It looks like we're doing a pretty good job, and we'll even try and do better. So with that being said, I will move House File 3159, the Ellison Bill, be recommended pass and sent to General Register.
Don't worry.
General Register. And again, Representative Allison, if we get into time constraint and we have folks that have driven some distance, we will revert to other bills to get their testimony on the record. But we will start out. I moved House File 3159, be recommended passed, sent to the General Register. So if you could join us at the table, Representative Allison. And there's, I believe, a Samuel Yaman.
Yeah, Yaman's here.
You can come down. What we'll do is we'll have Representative Ellison present his bill. Is there anyone that wishes to testify? Well, actually, I believe, to get the bill in the shape the author wants, we want a DE1 amendment? Or is this in addition to the 3159?
It's a delete all, Mr. Chair.
That's yours?
Yes.
It's a delete all, and generally in this committee, we get the bill in the shape the author would like first, and then we can do whatever we want to from there. So I will move the H3159DE1 amendment simply to get the bill in the shape the author would like so we know what we're working off of. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Motion prevails. We now have the amendment before us. If you could please present the bill, Representative Ellison, welcome to the Ag Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just to be clear on the Chair's instructions in the beginning, will the committee entertain the testimony of the testifiers at this time?
However you'd like to do it. Well, okay. What we'll do, I believe there's some opposition to the delete all we have. Can I see a show of hands of folks that have concerns about the DE1 amendment?
We've got to look at the DE, but the bill we did.
Okay.
We'll look at the DE.
Okay, so if you could please describe, Representative Ellison, the bill for us, and then we'll take your testimony with the people that are in support of it, and then we will go to people that have concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Mr. Chair and members, let me say that I do have tremendous respect and high regard for agriculture. I think anybody who eats is involved in agriculture, and that would definitely include me. I think that agriculture is everyone's business, and that everyone should be concerned about how we produce food and products that come from the agricultural sector. So, Mr. Chair, I do feel a part of what you're doing, and I do want to encourage members to not consider me an outsider to agriculture because I live in the urban area. I would like to let you know that both my mother and father grew up on farms in Louisiana and Georgia, and so I see myself as a displaced farm boy to a large extent. So let me say, Mr. Chair and members, that this bill is the Minnesota Migrant and Farm Worker Protection Bill. It talks about in the first, in Subdivision 2, which gets into the substance of it, it talks about implementation of procedures to devise comprehensive program to provide protection to migrant farm workers and migrant and farm workers, which would include identification of agricultural chemicals and pesticides that include herbicides, which migrant and farm workers are exposed. It would study the impact of those chemicals on farm workers who include migrant and seasonal workers. The bill calls for testing of wells and groundwater, and it also calls for testing in areas where the greatest exposure and where the request is made by farm workers, and to identify the immediate and long-term effects of exposure, including developmental impacts on unborn embryos and fetuses and so forth. Also, the bill calls for a tracking of pesticide exposure impact over time to see how the impact of pesticides is impacting the health of migrant farm workers. And the bill on Subdivision 3 calls for a 24-hour notice period, which would essentially state that if you're going to spray a pesticide, just let people know and give them a little time to react. I know that that is being done in many sections of our state, and I want to commend the farmers that do that, but I do think also that this provision is helpful to make sure we have uniformity, but that is with kudos and praise for the farmers who do that, and I know most do endeavor to do that. The next substantive section has to do with a report to the legislature so that we can see how we're doing. I think that today's report from the legislative auditor was very important to give us sort of a take our temperature in the state as to how we are doing, and got a lot of important information. I think that kind of continual monitoring is important. And then, Mr. Chair, members, the bill calls for a pilot project that would examine whether granting farm workers the right to get information about occupational health chemicals reduces the severity of work-related illnesses, and it would provide incentives and assistance to encourage safer pest control methods. Because there are organic pest control methods, as many members of the committee are well aware, and I think that we should begin moving to that to explore how we can better implement safer practices. So, Mr. Chair and members, this bill is not this bill really doesn't come call the use of pesticides into question. We recognize they're a fact of life and part of reality, but I think that we all can do better, and I think that this bill tries to address health risks to a vulnerable population. Mr. Chair, I will introduce to the committee Ms. Paula McAbee. Thank you.
Please state your name. Do you represent for the record? Thank you, Representative Allison.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Paula McAbee, and I'm an advocacy specialist helping out environmental justice advocates of Minnesota. And this issue came before Environmental Justice Advocates of Minnesota. I'm going to call it EJAM so it doesn't take up quite so much time. About a year and a half ago, we have an event once a year and invite people from the community. And some folks came down from Owatonna, from Central Campesino, and described their experience as workers, where the first time that they would know about pesticides is when the exposure actually occurred. But they wouldn't have the advance notice. And so we asked Representative Allison to look into doing something that would do two things. One, let workers know ahead of time if pesticides are going to be sprayed, because they are more exposed to them than other people.
And number two, start studying the health effects. It is disputed in the science how serious the health effects, how soon they appear, is there a rate of miscarriage or a problem with birth defects. And when we talk to, this bill doesn't say we're going to make a decision about what those exposures are and how badly people are off. It says we need to start studying. We need to find out in real time what people are being exposed to and what the effects that they're observing are. And we made the request to Representative Ellison before the report came up from the legislative auditor, and I think it's a good coincidence that these are coming at the same time. We did have a chance to read the report. And many of the things in the report, I believe, support what Representative Ellison is trying to do. And EGEM, once again, we're not taking a position that there should be no pesticide use, but that even if pesticide use is reasonable, evaluating the costs and the benefits, if many of the costs are being borne by workers who aren't even aware of them, that's the situation we have to change. And I'm just going to, I put some excerpts from, and please, I want to make it clear, this is a 117-page report, and I gave you about two or three pages. But what the auditor's report says, pesticides are substances that are intentionally added to the environment to kill or regulate some type of life. By their nature, they are toxic and therefore dangerous products to some degree. And also in this report, studies have shown that pesticides can pose risks even when used according to product labels. So there's nothing here suggesting that people aren't using pesticides right, but for the people who are exposed to them, that might still be a problem. Now, the recommendations of this report are that pesticide information become more available, particularly to people who live or work next to their application. And I would suggest that Representative Junkie has got a good point. If there were someone wanted to make a friendly amendment to add notification where there is use in an application in an urban environment, I think there's some similar issues. But what this report also identified is that one of the things that we need to look at is advanced notification of pesticide applications. And not just for bees, but the report also suggests to other applications where there could be an endangerment of health or human beings. And I just looked also at the report on pages 91 and 93, which I copied for you, is that the frequency of detection of pesticides in groundwater, that atrazine was found in 86% of the samples in 2004, alachlorin 50%, acetochlorin 30%. And if you look at the surface water, it would be 95% for atrazine and 69% for acetochlorin. Now, I know that many of the environmental advocates will say that the sources I copied from the APSDR or the US EPA are actually way too conservative about what they're saying about health. But even looking at these documents, if you look at atrazine, the APSDR says atrazine may affect pregnant women by causing their babies to grow more slowly than normal, and that atrazine enters the environment primarily through spraying on farm crops. And so in this document, they suggest that in order to prevent exposure to atrazine, that people should stay out of the fields when atrazine is immediately sprayed. Similarly, and this is on the back page of this small handout, it talks of this is the US EPA suggesting that acetochlor, which has been conditionally registered, is a carcinogen, but that the risks of this carcinogen can be kept reasonable as long as people take adequate precautions. So at the very bottom of the page, it says agriculture workers could be exposed to acetochlor primarily via the dermal route, mainly through the skin. Assuming that the maximum application rate is used and that workers wear long pants, long-sleeved shirts, and chemical-resistant gloves, EPA's estimate of the worst-case additional cancer risk ranges from about 2 to 40 in 1 million. In other words, if people take the appropriate precautions for applying these chemicals, the EPA says there's a risk of cancer, but it's a manageable risk. But if people don't know that that pesticide is going to be sprayed, don't know what precautions they should be taking and don't take the precautions, even looking at these government documents, we would be allowing a risk that is beyond that we should be allowing. So environmental justice advocates in Minnesota, speaking primarily for the community that came to us, the migrant and farm worker community, believes that we should be taking simple precautions let folks know when something is going to be sprayed. Have the health department help by informing people what precautions they can take. You know, should they take the kids in from playing nearby the field? Should they be covering their hands or their arms? And then start the process of studying what are people being exposed to and what the risks of that might be.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ellison.
Ms. Chela Velasquez from Central Capocino is here to present.
Can you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please?
I am Chela Vasquez from Centro Campesino, based in Owatonna, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The mission of Centro Campesino is to improve the lives of migrant agricultural workers and rural Latinos and be a strong voice for Latinos in South Central Minnesota. Our constituency is composed of farm workers who labor long days every year in the fields to produce the food that we eat at our table. As we have been discussing so far, modern conventional agriculture requires heavy inputs of chemicals, among them pesticides in particular. The people that are in close contact with these chemicals, with pesticides, are farm workers. 10, 12 hours a day when they work in the field every year, they're exposed to chemicals. Among the farm workers are migrant farm workers. The nature of agriculture in Minnesota requires that farm workers, migrant farm workers, are the ones that work in this, in crops, in producing our crops. Not so long ago, migrant agricultural workers, the families of migrant agricultural workers, were exposed to aerial spraying of pesticides because their houses are close to the fields. And when their fields were sprayed, they were also spraying on people because they didn't even know that pesticides were being sprayed, and children were playing outside with their mothers. And they know. One of the things that Centro Campesino did was to speak and to work with the company, so that now there is a warning system. But still the houses are close by. Yes, there is a buffer zone, but the houses are close by, and we don't know what are the long-term effects of pesticides on these people. And from speaking with our constituency, which are mostly farm workers, we know that the information and the knowledge about the impacts of pesticides is almost non-existent. First, they don't know what chemicals are there, and even if they know, we mention them, so they don't know what it means. Okay, addressing, okay, what is that? Because the assumption is that if they're working there, if they're employed to work, it must be safe. So for us, it's very important, the health of our constituency, because that's the future of our communities. And also another thing that's important is that farm workers in general don't have health insurance. So they don't receive medical attention except when it's very serious. And by then it's too late. There is no association. What happened? What diseases they have? And what is the association with being in such close contact with pesticides for so many hours every day? And also, what is the impact and the connection of being exposed to pesticides and how they may be exposing their families, their children, because there is not such an understanding among farm workers. So we welcome any measure to reduce chemical exposure of pesticides to farm workers, and also anything that leads to understanding more about what are the consequences of being exposed to pesticides to humans, in particular to farm workers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Vasquez. Representative Ellison, I'm working on time management here, and here's what I think we're going to need to do. We have folks have driven some distance for other bills here. Now, we're going to continue on yours here for a while, but the 3159 bill as originally introduced and the delete all amendment are quite different, and I see that the delete all has just been here since 1:11 p.m. of today is when it was printed. We have one meeting left on Tuesday. I want to take your testifiers here and possibly get some questions. But in fairness to the folks that have concerns about the bill, I don't think we'll be voting on this today, laying it over till Tuesday. Members, we have the room from 2:30 to 5:50 on Tuesday.
And we're probably going to have some carryover bills here. We've got one, two, three, four, five or six bills, and who knows, I've got some others that we might throw on there just for fun. And so we're going to be looking for a room from 7:30 till whenever. We're not going to lay your bill over not to vote on it. If we lay it over, it's my intention that we will have time to vote on it, but we are going to need some time for folks that have some concerns also. So with that being said, we'll continue, but I see some of the folks that have driven a distance are here, but you also have some more witnesses, and we'll want to take them. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, that sounds like a very reasonable way to proceed. The last witness for the bill is Mr. Samuel Yameen of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you very much. If I could get a little bit more information from Ms. Vasquez, you represent, it was something?
Centro Campesino.
Central Campesino.
My
middle daughter studied at the University of Guadalajara this last summer, and she's in the Spanish major, so.
She's fluent, you're not.
She's fluent, I don't have a clue.
Well, one more thing I would like to add is most of the farm workers are Latinos, and many of them don't speak English. So even if the information is in English, it's not adequate, I would say.
That's a very good
And also,
question.
Even if the information is there, it's one thing to have something written and then the understanding. What's the connection between a sign that's there and your health? What's the connection between a sign that's there and this health of your children? There is no such an understanding. There is no understanding of that part. And that's the part that I think it should be addressed, the adequacy of the information.
Point very well taken. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Is it Yameen or Yaman? Or?
Thank you, Samuel Yaman, Public Health Scientist, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will try to keep this brief with respect to everyone's time and the things that people are here to work on.
Representative Coonan, while he's getting that set up, Representative Coonan, do you have anyone here to testify on your bill?
Jerry
Schoenfeld? Okay, he's...
Seinfeld? Jerry Seinfeld.
You need to live on this place up there. Did he bring Kramer or
what? Okay, please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Samuel Yaman. I'm here today to provide scientific perspectives on the pesticide-related health risks faced by farm workers that were just described by the other testifiers. Here's an outline of the fundamental concepts I will discuss. Exposure, in this context, means your body comes in contact with a hazardous chemical such as a pesticide. Exposure can occur through breathing, through the skin or eyes, and by drinking or eating. When there is an exposure, there is a potential risk. Farm workers have high exposure to pesticides and other occupational hazards. I will describe some of the health effects that result from pesticide exposures. The health effects are generally grouped as either acute or chronic effects. Acute effects are short-term effects like poisoning. Chronic effects are long-term impacts like cancer, reproductive problems, and nervous system disorders. Here are some figures that demonstrate the magnitude of the risk of serious pesticide exposures among farm workers. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimates that there are between 10,000 and 20,000 pesticide poisonings each year among farm workers in the U.S. The health effects can include rashes, headaches, nausea and vomiting, disorientation, loss of coordination, and even coma and death. These short-term high exposures to pesticides occur 34 times more often among farm workers than among people in other occupations. And many of these pesticide illnesses occur among youths who are working on farms, not just among adult workers. Now we'll move on to discuss what the scientific literature has demonstrated on the long-term health risk for farm workers. and a series of studies on members of the United Farm Workers of America, researchers have found elevated risk for several types of cancer among the workers, including leukemia, stomach cancer, uterine and cervical cancer, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. In some of the studies, the researchers linked higher rates of cancer to specific pesticides. For example, workers who were exposed to the herbicide 2,4-D had nearly a four times higher risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. A number of studies have linked reproductive problems to pesticide exposures. University of Minnesota researchers have found a higher frequency of birth defects and miscarriages among pesticide applicators and their families in the Red River Valley. Other studies have found high risk for infertility and spontaneous abortion among farm families in Ontario and Wisconsin. And these studies have mostly looked at herbicides as the risk factors, including 2,4-D and atrazine, among others. Most insecticides work by attacking the nervous system of insects, and these chemicals can also have strong effects on the human nervous system. These include short-term effects like dizziness, nausea, and disorientation, but long-term effects on the nervous system of farm workers have also been documented. Scientific studies have demonstrated the impacts on the brain and nervous system of farm workers by testing behavioral and cognitive responses, and also by monitoring biological indicators such as the nervous system enzymes. And recent studies have also begun to show a link between pesticides and Parkinson's disease. Here's a graph showing the total usage in Minnesota of pesticides that are nervous system toxins. Most of these are organophosphate insecticides, but some are organochlorine and carbamate insecticides. These pesticides vary in their toxicity, with some being in the most toxic category, as ranked by U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and some of the others are somewhat less potent. Not all of them are used in agriculture, but from this graph you can see that overall there's not a downward trend in the use of nervous system toxins, which means we need to do more to protect farm workers and other people who might be exposed to these chemicals. Young children of farm workers can be exposed to pesticides when their parents or older brothers and sisters come home from work. And pesticides can be tracked into the home on the clothes and shoes of farmers and farm workers. Children can also be exposed when pesticides are applied and the chemicals drift onto nearby homes, which is often where the farm workers reside. Researchers have actually gone into these homes and found higher levels of pesticides in the dust and on floors and surfaces inside the homes. Other studies have found evidence that children in agricultural communities have pesticide-related deficits in brain and nervous system function. Children of farm workers have also been shown to have higher risk for cancer, which has been linked to their parents' exposure to pesticides. And in conclusion, the usefulness of this scientific research is that it helps demonstrate that there is a clear and urgent need to improve protections for farm workers and their families in order to reduce the harmful impacts of pesticides and other occupational hazards that they encounter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Damon. That was very interesting. Could you get us hard copies of the PowerPoint at some
point? Sure, I'd be glad to do so.
Thank you very much. If you could get that to us as soon as you can, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Allison.
That would conclude the testifiers for the bill. I want to thank you for allowing us to make the presentation. If there are any questions or however you want to proceed.
Okay.
But that is the end of the that's all for our testifiers.
Thank you very much, Representative Allison. I will open it up at this point. And again, this bill will be laid over till the 28th so that the folks that have concerns about the DE1 amendment can take a look at it and figure out what how it would impact their industries and so forth. With that being said, we will entertain questions for the folks that we have at the front table. Any questions of members? Otherwise, we'll go on to Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, to the last testifier, excuse me with the name. Gentlemen, you mentioned in your presentation that not all were used in agriculture. What are some of the other uses, and would you like to see the notification applied to those uses also?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have a clear delineation of which pesticides are used in agriculture and which ones are not. I mean, to be honest, I'd be stepping a little bit outside of my knowledge base if I tried to answer that question. So,
Mr. Yeaman, we've always considered you're honest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Hamilton? That's just a pet peeve of mine, people say, to be honest with you. I think, what were you being? You know. Representative Hamilton.
Well, again, it's kind of a follow-up on to the point that Representative Junkie made earlier about the use of the pesticides in the urban areas and stuff like that. And I understand that you, all four of you up there, do have concerns in how they're used, how they're applied, and looking for additional notification. My question is, do you also support including the usage of these, including the reporting of the usage of these in the urban areas, et cetera? That'd be my question.
Mr. Chair, yes. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that the legislative auditor's report pointed out, is that dealing with pesticides in the urban area is something that isn't done very well, and we don't know much about. And I think, Representative Hamilton, you are dead on. And as a matter of fact, I'm trying to figure out, you know, exactly how to deal with this problem. Is, you know, notice, certainly monitoring, certainly studying this. You know, we need to do something about the problem. I agree wholeheartedly. And today I don't have the solution. I'd like to get together with some people to talk about it. But I mean, that I think you're absolutely right, and I can't improve on. And I your point's well taken.
Representative Hamilton. Okay, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick clarifying question, I guess, for my knowledge. I apologize. The gal on the right, your left.
Ms. Vasquez.
There you go, Ms. Vasquez. How many migrant workers do we have in the state, and what type of production agriculture are they working in?
Ms. Vasquez.
Migrant agricultural workers come to Minnesota, and the numbers range sometimes 50,000, 35,000. The numbers that we don't have a fixed number, but it ranges 18,000 to 34,000 is what you find in the literature. They're all over the state. In South Central Minnesota, they work on seasonal crops such as corn, peas, and they also work for canning companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to notice that corn, for example, uses lots of chemicals. And we do have reports from youth that work, for example, in seed companies. Seed companies employ labor for 2 or 3 weeks a year. Yeah. It's a very short season in order to detassel corn. And then you find youth 13, 14, 15 years old working there for 10, 12 hours a day. And when we speak to them, they have no idea what they are exposed, or even if we mention a chemical, they have no clue what does it mean, how it can affect them.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Representative Pinstead.
Well, maybe this is for someone with the department. I'm just curious about what type of state laws or federal laws there are for protection of employees in those professions, I guess. I see someone from the department.
We have the gentleman from the Department of Ag step down here. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify for this bill? Okay, thank you. So we'll wrap it up with this. Representative Finn is the last one on the list, unless somebody else comes up here. If you could please state your name. And Representative Ellison, I'm thinking about time management here again. With the amendment, it says Commissioner of Health. So if it would pass out on Tuesday, I would say, in health would be okay because it's health policy and finance. So it would have met deadline if it would pass.
We're all right.
Okay, we're okay on that point. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, Paul Lemont, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I manage the regulatory and response program for pesticides and fertilizers. The question was, are there laws in place now and what is being done? Indeed, there are. I haven't had a chance to read the bill, whether or not it is essentially redundant or if it adds to what we already have in place. But a couple points to make. First, the U.S. EPA, when it registers pesticides, it does a wholesale comprehensive risk assessment on those products for human exposure, and the labeling contemplates how they can be used with minimal risk. In addition to that, the federal government has passed what is called a worker protection standard, which has been in place now for probably 8 or 10 years. The Department of Agriculture in Minnesota enforces that law as part of pesticide use labeling. The Legislative Auditor's Report on page 45 has a table which details that right now, of our inspectors' hours on pesticide-related work in fiscal year 2005, at least 13% of our time, of our inspectors' time, was devoted to ensuring that farm workers and handlers were protected under that worker protection standard. And indeed, we've taken dozens of enforcement actions, including penalty actions, when we found noncompliance. So there is not a void right now. My quick reading of the bill is that it extends beyond what the federal law currently covers to families, to children, and so forth. So those are not contemplated in the federal worker protection standard.
Sir, can you please spell your last name for the record?
Lemont is L-I-E-M-A-N-D-T.
L-I-E-M-E-N-D-T. Okay, thank you. There's somebody else been looking at this, too. There's rules promulgated by the Department of Commissioner of Health, so I don't know if GovOps is going to be after us or what. I'm not sure what we got there. I'm trying to figure out how to do this and not, you know, with the deadline and so forth.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, what I asked the Chair to do, if we can get this bill out of this committee to send us to Health, and then
I think that's what I'll do. We haven't had a request from GovOps, and that'd be my intention at this point. Okay, Representative Finstead.
Well, they haven't seen the
Representative Finstead. And then that's going to be it for questions after Representative Finstead.
I guess I would just, you know, thank the department for coming down, and I'd ask Representative Ellison if you know, in what the department just testified, then would it be your I guess assumption or the need for this bill based on the fact that you don't think the department is doing their job? If I could get your thoughts on that, and then Mr. Chair, I can follow up with the author. You said next week is when we'll move
Tuesday.
This? Okay. I have some time to follow
thank
up.
For so thank you. And members be working on this. This is a very important bill we're looking at here. So with that, I will lay the bill over, not on the table, so I don't have to have a vote to bring it up. I'm laying it over, so it's my intention just to bring it up whenever I feel like it on Tuesday, which we will do.
Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ellison. We will now go to, I'm going to go to the Coonan bill. Because I'd like to clean some of these up if we can get them out.
My testifier's here, too. When I
okay, so we've got Junkie, Welty, and Coonan. Is there anyone that wishes to testify against the...
Mr. Chairman, this bill, civil penalties, if it were actually go to court and if there was a found to be the law would be broken. It has to do with operating tractors with disconnector and non-functional clock meters with the intent to defraud and selling tractors knowing that the hours are incorrect. This bill I've been kind of dragging my feet on for the last 3 years, probably based on personal experience that I've never had trouble with this in my 27 years of farming. But if you look in your packets, there's a letter from a farmer from Sacred Heart, Rodney Skalbeck, who got stung bad on a combine deal. This bill is actually a compromise that the South Dakota, Minnesota farm equipment dealers have agreed to, and I don't know if Jerry Schoenfeld is here or not. He was going to speak to that, but
Representative Cooten, the association is supporting this compromise.
Yes, it's a compromise they agreed to. Yeah, and I would like to point out to committee members also that the language in the bill does include farmers too, or anybody who would sell a tractor. So when you make your decisions at what you're going to do, keep that in mind also.
Any questions of the author? Seeing none, Representative Coonan renews his motion. House File 1466, and I need to change it, be sent to civil law. They want to see it.
Yeah.
Because it's, yeah. Okay, any further questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. This 1466 is passed on to civil law and elections.
Thank you.
Item next, Representative Welty, and then Representative Junkie. Both have folks here to testify. They've driven some distance. Representative Welty, I understand that there is no is there anyone that wishes to testify against the Welty bill? You know what that means, Representative Welty?
Short version?
Short version. If you could, please have, we do want to hear from the folks that have come up, and that would be, where am I here? It would be a Preston, Minnesota native, Tom Anderson, farm business manager, Riverland Community College, Mark Gelstead, Dairy Farmers, Number of Falls, and Ed Jostock, Dairy Farmers, Number of Falls. Is that correct? If you please come up with Representative Welty here and present your bill, and then we will go to the Representative Junction bill. Okay, Representative Welty, please present your bill, sir.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 3366, which is before you, establishes a revolving loan program study that the Department of Agriculture will do in conjunction with the Department of Employee and Economic Development, or DEED. And I have talked to both departments, and both departments are willing to absorb this study within their existing resources that they have, so there will be no cost to this. We are waiting on the fiscal note that would essentially verify that. We don't have that in front of us right now, but if there's anybody from either of those departments that wants to tell me that that's not the case, they can. But I did talk to Jim Borboom in the Department of Agriculture and Paul Moe in DEED.
Representative Welty, to get the bill in the shape you'd like, is the A1 amendment your amendment?
Yes, I would like to, Mr. Chair, I move the A1 amendment to be incorporated into House File 3366.
To get the bill in the shape the author would like, any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended, as the author would like. If you could please present your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
I cut you off. What does it do?
I was wondering if you wanted to hear what the bill actually did.
Well, when I say short, I didn't mean that short.
Well, the study will be a study which is a $500 per cow, maximum of 100 cows per producer, revolving loan program. And what we're asking the Department of Agriculture and DEED to do is to find out if there are private dollars available in the state of Minnesota that could be matched with public dollars. I think it's in the interest of many of our agribusinesses to make sure that the cows stay in Minnesota. I think if we wait until the cows come home, that may not happen. And Representative Erdahl, of course, has brought his dairy investment tax credit bill forward, which I would love to see passed this year. And I think that this, in combination with the dairy investment tax credit, would send a message that Minnesota wants to maintain, if not grow, our dairy industry. And this idea actually came from Wisconsin. And I know we always talk about the other states that are doing things successfully. Wisconsin established a revolving loan program, $500 per cow, up to 2,000 cows. So it's up to $1 million per dairy producer. Since 2002, they have doled out over $12 million. And they have kept thousands of cows in the state of Wisconsin, if not brought new ones in. And I think that we don't have in Minnesota the resources that Wisconsin had. Wisconsin used HUD money. We don't have that available to us now. I've checked into that. And so what I am doing is thinking outside the box, thinking creatively of how we can leverage resources that we have in Minnesota with public funding to come up with a revolving loan program, if that's something that the report shows is needed. The amendment, just to bring that to your attention, the amendment asks both agencies to come up with the administration costs for the fund, and what I'm hoping is that we could have a revolving loan fund where the interest is paid essentially pays for the administration costs, and we keep it at a low interest loan. They look at the terms of the loan, the producer eligibility requirements, and also the amount that is needed from the private sector matched by the public sector to create the revolving loan program. And with that, that's the bill, and I'll turn it over to my testifiers. And first I'll introduce Tom Anderson, who's a farm business manager with Riverland Community College in southeastern Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anderson. Please provide your testimony.
He's going to pass out my comments here. As is indicated, I'm Tom Anderson, the farm business management instructor at Riverland Community College, located in Plainview, Minnesota. I've had the opportunity and privilege of working over the past several years at 50 dairy farms through the MinSCU Farm Business Management Program. In southeast Minnesota, we have benefited from a positive environment and a desire to dairy farm on a very average size scale. I'm here to encourage you to enact a study to determine whether or not a milk volume production revolving loan as enacted in other states would be beneficial to Minnesota. Unlike many other areas of the country, southeast Minnesota has a great attitude about the future of the dairy industry. We have young families who desire to become involved in the dairy industry, be it with their existing families or to venture out on their own with their own ventures. Milk production in our home county of Wabasha has had a great increase in overall milk production. In fact, reports show that Wabasha County is one of the leading states in the United States, the leading counties in the United States, for the greatest percentage increase in milk production over the past 5 years. Yet with all this enthusiasm, interest, and skilled young men and women possessing the desire to dairy, we lack the access to capital funding for cows. I work with young dairy producers every day who desire to grow the dairy numbers. But each and every situation is filled with the complexities trying to fund the cattle purchase. I have one producer who resorted to leasing cows from a Wisconsin leasing company to fill his barn to capacity. The lease terms worked out to approximately 21% interest rate. The additional access to capital funding for cows would be a tremendous benefit to allow this producer, along with many others, to fill the barn to capacity and to fulfill the cash flow projections. The federal FSA programs are limited to $200,000. This limitation is oftentimes inadequate to fill the barn to capacity when cow prices are now averaging nearly $2,000 a cow. The dairy industry is filled with an aging population, but younger generations have a strong desire to dairy. Unfortunately, the cost of building improvements, we often run short on the capital to fill the barn with cows. I firmly believe that we need to study the possibilities of the milk volume capital revolving loan. I fully expect that we will find it to be one tool in the toolbox of the Minnesota dairy producer to fund the cattle purchase and for Minnesota to maintain its market share in the dairy industry. The dairy industry is very competitive, but it's also true that Minnesota is one of the greatest locations in the country to produce milk. Our climate, our natural resources, our access to quality feeds, the expansion of ethanol plants, the enthusiasm of our producers, the support of our agricultural lenders, and the infrastructure currently in place are all reasons to study this capital improvement proposal. I ask for your support in studying this proposal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I'd like to introduce to the committee Mark Felstead, who is a dairy producer in southeastern Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Mark Felstead, dairy producer. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you please present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I am Mark Felstead. My wife, Diane, and I operate 150-cow dairy just north of Rochester in Wabasha County. After managing a dairy in Wisconsin for 5 years, we started to explore the idea of purchasing my parents' farm and renovating the 40-cow dairy to its current size. In 2004, we moved back to Minnesota, I'm saying now, and began the task of building a 108-cow freestall barn, while at the same time remodeling the old tie-stall barn to accommodate a double-six step-up farmer. Our goal is to work full-time together on the dairy, producing a quality product with quality, well-cared cattle, and continue to expand as needed to remain competitive and profitable. To do this expansion and renovation, along with the farm purchase, we had to use tools available to us at the time. We worked with FSA on a direct loan program for cattle that we needed to purchase, and a guaranteed loan program for the real estate loan. The direct loan for FSH's capped at 200,000, which made it difficult to reach the number of cows needed to build our operation. We had to come up with our own operating out-of-pocket monies to cover the higher cost of cattle to reach the numbers needed to cash flow. If we were able to access money from a program such as Representative Wealthy is putting together, we would have been able to add 25 to 30 more cows, adding money to our bottom line and the state's. Budget money we all know is tight, but the investment that Minnesota makes would be well worth its return. Each additional cow would add cash to our cash flow and at the same time give the state of Minnesota an increase in income. In the year we expanded, our proposed property taxes increased by 104%, almost doubling the county, township, and school district funds that are going back. Minnesota would benefit adding cattle to its economy, therefore increasing its market share in the milk industry. If we continue to lose cattle, we'll lose our position as one of the U.S.'s leading dairy states, more so than we already have. These benefits will not only help our personal bottom line, but also local level by providing needed services from local businesses. Minnesota corn growers and Minnesota soybean growers have stepped up to the plate and are supporting the livestock industry in Minnesota. They have recognized the importance of keeping their commodities in the state. Many young dairy farmers and future dairy farm is faced with the undaunting task of trying to begin a dairy with little or no equity or cash outlay. And like many businesses starting out, the number that fail the first year is large. On an average farm, we need to make approximately a $4,000 investment to begin his operation. With this program, it may just give the extra boost to the beginner whose dream it may be to dairy farm in Minnesota. If Minnesota can provide a helpful hand to these young and possible expanding dairy people, I feel it would be a win-win situation from the dairy farmer to the township, to the county, to the state, and everyone in between. I feel it would be beneficial to study further Representative Wealthy's bill. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. On behalf of my wife and myself, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, sir. We'll go now to Mr. Ed Jostock. Right, excuse me, Representative Welty, how's this doing in the Senate?
It passed, and it's going to the Senate floor.
Senate floor, okay. Welcome, committee, sir.
Yeah, welcome. Welcome, Chairman and Representative. I'm Ed Jostock, and I guess the only thing there is I'm from Rochester, Minnesota, but just south of Zumber Falls. I'm here to speak on behalf of Representative Welty's bill. I apologize. I left my notes at home. I had to pull a calf before I come. But anyway, I have four children and my wife, and we dairy with 50 dairy cows in Wabash County. And I think anything that we can do and any extra things for the dairy that we're having in Minnesota is very important to the economy of Minnesota. And that's why I drove up here today to support this bill. And I hope that you, as representatives, would also support it because I think it's very important to the state of Minnesota. And having my third child, a son, that's graduating from high school this year and come from Elgin High School last year to graduate out of that school over there because they're merging with Plainview. But the point of it is I hear talk with those kids when they're talking, and I think there's 3-4 potential dairy producers out of that small graduating class of Elgin High School. And I think if they have opportunities like this one and many of the other bills that are out there, that they could have a chance in becoming dairy farmers also. And, you know, maybe taking over my operation or other dairy farmers' operations. But thank you for your time to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Jostock. Any questions for any witnesses? Representative Heigerken?
Thank you, Mr. Welty, and a good bill. My question has to do with, and I'm familiar with, Wisconsin has used the HUD program very effectively. What is the reasoning here that it's not used? Have you got a...
Representative Welty?
Representative Heigerken, you know, I wish those HUD dollars were available here. Right. The HUD dollars, as I understand it, Wisconsin had excess HUD dollars in about 2000, 2001, mm-hmm. and so they tapped into those and they used those for economic development. The way Wisconsin works their program is that the state
gives you the loan, you pay that back to the local EDA. The local EDA then can turn around and invest that into other dairies and other ag businesses in that area.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that opportunity anymore in the state of Minnesota. As I am told, there are over $20 million of requests outstanding for HUD dollars. That's beyond what we already pay out for the HUD program. So we just don't have any HUD dollars available.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, Representative Welty moves that House file, which one we got? 3366 as a move to be recommended, passed, and sent to the Ag Environment Finance, so that makes deadline there. Why finance?
Can we send it, if there's no cost, can we send it to the straight to the General Register, Mr. Chair?
I believe I said House File 3366 as amended to be sent to the General Register.
That's
I thought that's what I said. With that being said, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing no opposition, motion prevailed. Thank you,
Representative
Welty. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the thank you, members of the committee.
Paul. Thank you. Been a long day. One left. Representative Junkie moves House File 3442 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Welcome, Committee Representative Junkie. Is there anyone here that wishes to testify in opposition, other than Representative Heiger?
Thanks, bud.
To Representative Junkie's bill. Okay, Representative Junkie, will you please present your bill and introduce your witness after you've made your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this bill, I'm happy to go to the General Register. I will tell you, it did just pass the Senate Ag Committee, and they sent it to Finance only because it captures $50,000 if this program is sunset, or half of it for half the biennium, or I'm not sure, maybe it's annually. And I suppose they figured they could spend the money somewhere. So they went to Finance, but we can go wherever you want. I don't care. Members, this bill came down to me actually by request of the chair. I got a call and said, call Junkie and see what he thinks. And so I thank you for that. I do have some beet producers.
No, Representative Junkie, I thank you.
Oh, I do have some beet producers in my district. But I'll let the witness explain what's going on. I just want to say basically what this bill does is sunset the I don't know what the warehouse operator stuff is in here. I honestly don't. This bill, the way it's drafted, has some, I don't know if the department needed something done here or what. That first section, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sullivan, to the question of Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Junkie. I'm not sure either why that reference to the beekeeping chapter is there, but I think it was just removed just to clean up that reference and remove it.
No, the beekeeping is what this is about. I'm asking about Section 1.
Right. I think for some reason Section 1 references the beekeeping chapter, so just to clean up the statutes, that would be taken
out. Okay, so it was a cleanup as long as it was there.
First objection.
Okay. Basically, what we're interested in, members, is the repealer page, and it repeals the beekeeping statutes, but only the ones listed there. I did get one call, I will be honest, today from one of your cohorts that were worried because they ship bees outside of the state and they do need the department to inspect. And I would point out that 19.64 that is repealed, it's only Subdivision 1 that's repealed, and I handed you that page in particular so you could see it yourself. It's Subdivision 4A is still there, which does permit the commissioner to make inspections for sale of bees and equipment, et cetera, if that's needed for transport and other things. So we're not repealing that section that allows that to happen. So we're not impeding the commerce of bees. If the department inspection is needed, they can come out and inspect and charge the fee for it. That part is not being repealed. So I think that's, when I talked to your cohort up in Northwest Minnesota, actually, they seem to be satisfied with that. I also handed out a letter dated February 22nd that I got from the Minnesota Honey Producers Association, the Hobby Beekeeping Association, and the Apiary Advisory Committee, explaining again, too, why they thought these weren't needed anymore. Originally, the statutes were set up for one purpose. Currently in law, they don't see the purpose for it. But again, Mr. Chair, with that, and there was one other thing as we get into it with the testifier. And I did talk to Lynn Cheney yesterday from the department, and they have been working with these folks too over the last year. We may want to make a change of date for implementation. They did that in the Senate, and I'll let the testifier tell you what day, because of when the licensing comes, They would be paying for their next license fee, and a month later be repealed. If we repeal like on July 1st, I think they paid a month previous, so we may want to change a date on here. But I'll, again, I'll let them.
Be best to go at date of enactment?
Yeah. Yeah, date of upon enactment or signature of the governor,
because
whatever.
The bill itself is silent to a date.
And so then it would be a standard
August 1st,
date, which
probably.
Is, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But anyway, we'll let our testifier talk and see. He can maybe advise us on some of that.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Mr. Fred Holte, President of Minnesota Honey Producers Association. Will you please present your testimony, sir?
Thank you, Chairman David and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Fred Holte, the president of Minnesota Honey Producers. And I'd like to state, first of all, that the Minnesota Honey Producers are a statewide organization open to all people that are involved in the keeping of bees, commercial beekeepers who make their living, the hobby beekeepers who do this for something extra to challenge their minds, to packers of honey, suppliers of bee supplies, government officials, and the general public. Through our membership, we represent about 90% of the beehives in Minnesota, and in kind, I represent about 90% of the honey produced in Minnesota. And Minnesota annually produces in the neighborhood of 12 to 16 million pounds of honey, usually ranking us in the top 4 or 5 honey-producing states. Next year, we will celebrate our centennial, so we indeed have been a part of Minnesota agriculture for a considerable time period. To the file, bee laws were first established in the early 1900s to regulate and contain the spread of bee diseases in bee colonies. Later, these laws were upgraded to include pests and parasites that might affect bee colonies. And about 10 years ago, the laws were amended again to include exotic strains of bees. I might point out that all situations are endemic only to beekeepers and bees. They have no effect to the public. In other words, if bees were happen to get sick, it's not like a bird flu that can mutate and go and affect the public. Beekeepers themselves, given the tools and techniques that are available, despite the continuing challenges of changing agriculture, have in fact maintained status quo with the number of hives and even expanded the honey industry in many areas. And the tools and the techniques that we use come from research, education, and extension. Regulatory programs do little to provide us any tools. During the last 4 years, or 4 decades rather, the honey industry has become increasingly mobile. Hives are moved throughout the country to provide pollination service contracts. The fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, seed crops. Hives are also moved to warmer areas of the country where we do what's called an increase or make brood or nursery stock and expand bee numbers.
Mr. Holte? I'm going to ask a question here of folks in the room. Is there anyone that opposes the junkie bill that we're on? We have to be out of the room in 1 minute.
Okay.
So I think he got the votes. I suggest we cut and run if that's okay with you.
It works just fine for me.
Okay. Any questions from members? Okay. Seeing none, Representative, let's amend the bill. Representative Junkie moves on House File 3442 that we amend the bill. After page 1, line 16, insert section 3, effective date. Sections 1 and 2 are effective immediately following final enactment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, Representative Junkie moves that House File 3442 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the General Register. Any further comments or questions? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And that's the way to pass the bill.
Thank you, members.
That's the way to do it. Okay. Members, brief announcement, then we need to be out of this room. And I'm sorry to do that, Mr. Holte. Thank you for your testimony. The 28th, Representative Welty.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that whoever has been organizing our files, I want to commend you for doing this. This is great. This is the best committee I've served on yet.
Thank you, Representative Welty.
Don't throw
you,
them
Steph.
Green things away then.
We reuse them.
Yeah, gotta reuse them.
Thank you, Representative Welty. The 28th, our next meeting, we'll have up first 3546, tennis bill, beef diagnostic pilot project, the mole bill, genetically modified rice. Apparently there's been an agreement made on that. Then Huntley DFL, I'm not sure if this one, well, I guess we know Huntley DFL. Maritime vessels exempted from biodiesel requirements. I don't know if that's okay yet or not. We'll find out. Then two Magnus bills, 3375, 3376. We've got an R by his name. No letter by Demmer's name. We've got two for Magnus, bushel threshold regulated, grain buyer financial statements requirement modified, Demmer farm enhancement loan program established, and finish up the Ellison bill. And that's it, unless I hear differently from members or other members. So with that, good government all the time, we are adjourned. Thank you.